Good afternoon, Muskegon. This is Tony Williams without Chauncey Williams. Chauncey's on a sabbatical until the end of November because he was selected as a trailblazer, and we thought that it would not be appropriate for him to have radio airtime while others were still being nominated. So, I am flying solo today on our show, What Do I Do Now? Your Guide to Credit, Debt, and Planning for Your Financial Success. And as usual, we always start off with a little sports talk. So today we're going to do a little recap on the high school football playoffs. And of course, Muskegon won last week against Holland, which it was a very interesting game. We kind of got off to a slow start, but Big Reds finally got it together and played Big Red football to put away the Holland Dutchman. So this week we move on to play Zeeland West. And, of course, there's been quite a bit of buzz around Muskegon because of the moving of the football game. And we'll get back to that for a short period of time as we go down our list, as we got Mona Shores, who will be playing at Grand Rapids Forest Hill Central, which that team is undefeated, so that should be a great matchup. We got Grant at Oak Ridge, Kent City, Montague, both of those are undefeated. Catholic Central will head over to Minden, which is undefeated, so they will have their hands filled too. So hopefully we can get through these second round games and continue on to the road to Ford Field and have at least four teams playing down there over the Thanksgiving weekend. That would be fantastic. And of course, our Lions went down to defeat Sunday night at Pittsburgh against Pittsburgh, but they were at home. But again, they're on primetime TV again this week, Monday night at the Packers. So that should be a very interesting game, and maybe the Lions can get back to 500. So as far as football is concerned, that's it. Pistons are playing pretty good at their new venue, Little Caesars Arena. But they're not able to get folks to come downtown and watch the Pistons play, which is kind of a head-scratcher. We really thought that moving those Pistons back downtown that would garner a lot more support from the Detroit market, but watched a few games over the last week and there are a lot of empty seats at Little Caesars Arena, so sounds like they got a lot of marketing work to do in Detroit to get folks to come out and support the Pistons downtown. And our Memphis Grizzlies, which we have a loco interest in, Deontay Davis, they're 5-2. Which is great. And my beloved Cavs are struggling. They're below 500. Three wins and four losses. But I think they'll eventually get it together and make that run for another NBA championship. So we'll see how that turns out. But we're going to move on and talk a little bit more about the Muskegon Zeeland West football game and why it's being played at Grand Haven. I think it's important we share a few moments so our audience understands that it was not just a arbitrary decision to move that game. There's a lot of thought went into it. Unfortunately, this time of the year, these things do happen. The amount of rain that we've had over at Hackley Stadium doesn't help. Grounds crew over there has done a fantastic job in preparing that field to be played on. But with the amount of rain we have and no sunlight to help remove some of the moisture, really put the administration in a situation where they had to make a decision and not wait till the last minute because, you need time to prepare to move the game to another venue. And, of course, no one likes to do that. But I think based on the weather, it was a decision that had to be made. And in the best interest of our kids, we have to move the game. And it's not so much about revenue, because State of Michigan gets most of the revenue from these home football games anyway. It's just the fact that you get to play in your friendly confines of Hackley Stadium. And unfortunately, you know, the field started to get a little bit loose towards the end of the Holland game. We could watch a couple kids make cuts and watch the footing come out from under them. And we knew if we took on any more rain and not really had sunlight, that is going to make it more difficult when Friday came around. So that decision was made. Folks at Grand Haven were kind enough to allow us to use their facility. But that leads me to talk about what are we going to do as a community to eliminate this problem. And that being purchasing field turf. It's not a very inexpensive endeavor. We're looking at about $750,000 to have field turf installed at Hackley Stadium. But as a community, I think it's time that we got together and tried to come up with a plan to get this done. The complaining about moving it won't fix the problem. And our goal is to make this happen every year, is to go deep in the playoffs. Last year, we were fortunate. We didn't have the amount of rain that we've gotten this year. But overall, the field is in relatively good shape, but not as good as we would like it to be come Friday night. So if you're listening and you are a Big Red supporter, you need to contact me so we can start putting together a plan to raise money to get field turf installed. We can always point to other folks to get it done, but I think it's not going to happen if we take that position. So I am willing to be a part of this effort to get field turf at Hackley Stadium, but I need the help and support of those in the community that you know, feel as passionately as I do about Big Red football, Big Red sports, and I'm challenging you to contact me, and let's start putting something together to make it happen. My phone number is 231-903-0314. Just give me a call, and we'll set some dates to meet, talk, discuss a plan to move forward. Let's make it happen. So with that, we're going to wait and see what kind of response we get from the community. And we'll get into the show. So a couple of weeks ago, we had talked about Hurricane Harvey and the devastation that it caused throughout the Texas area. And today they released a report that all the vehicles, about a half a million cars and trucks that were damaged by Harvey, have been sitting impromptu in holding lots. They're set to get back out on the roads and the scrapyards salvaged with salvage titles, and thousands more that are uninsured and in the wild and could be headed anywhere with no information stating they've been in a flood. The National Insurance Crime Bureau said more than 422,000 such insured vehicles have been parked. And in a comparison, there were 300 vehicle claims from Hurricane Katrina, 250,000 from Superstorm Sandy, and another 215,000 in the Hurricane Irma in Florida. About a million vehicles are expected to have been damaged by Hurricane Harvey alone. 1 million. That's a lot. So they've been holding these cars, processing them for salvage title. That's for the insured vehicles. They will be processed, rebranded with salvage titles, and either sold at auctions for parts or crushed and sold for scrap. The cars and trucks will have their VINs entered in the NICB's VIN check database, where consumers can see if the vehicles have been damaged or branded as salvage. The VINs are also put into the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System. And, of course, this is not the case for thousands of uninsured vehicles that were damaged in the storm. The council, Insurance Council of Texas, said about 15% of the Texas drive of Texans drive without insurance. And many of these cars will be sold without the identification of being involved in a flood. So many vehicles that weren't insured will be cleaned up and sold with no indication of any damage. But there are some due diligence on the part of used vehicle shoppers that you can use. So if you're in the market and you want to make sure a car or truck is not a flood survivor, some recommendations include checking the vehicle's carpeting for water damage, looking for rust on screws or metallic bolts that typically won't get wet, and seeing if there are water stains on seat belts or interior upholstery. Another area to check for water damage is under the spare tire. It's also a good look for mud or other signs of earthy residue in the engine compartment. If interior and exterior lights look foggy, it's a sign the car or truck could have spent some time submerged in water. And of course, the smell of mold or other otherwise musty odor is also an indication that the car may have been in some kind of a flood. And in short, if the history report seems questionable, use your ears, your nose, and your best judgment before purchasing these used vehicles, because they will show up in the Midwest, because they want to get those cars out of the South, up in the North at very, very good pricing. So sometimes, the old saying that if the price is too good to be true, there's probably an issue with the vehicle. But as the article mentioned, a lot of times if you go in on the VIN identification website, it will tell you what the history of that car is, if it has been involved in a flood. And if so, you want to steer clear of that car because of so many electronic components that are in new cars today. And they may last, 6 months or 6 minutes. You never know. And a lot of times at auctions, when you buy a vehicle, you're buying that vehicle as is, and you have no recourse. So, again, do your due diligence and make sure that the vehicle you're buying is not a salvage vehicle. Moving on to our next subject. Interesting reading that I ran across, and it's not a subject that is going to help you with your finances, but it's a subject that will give you some insight into what communities can be if they spend their monies within a community. Interesting story. It's called The Destruction of Black Wall Street. And this is like 92 years ago. But if you do your, do some research and read about Black Wall Street, it's very interesting to note the communities that were vibrant and prospering back in the 20s. The one community in question is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it's called the Greenwood Community. And it happened during the oil boom of the 1900s. And many folks were moving to Tulsa for a shot at quick economic gains and high life, and African Americans hoped to prosper from the new industry as well. Tulsa, like many cities and towns throughout the U.S., were hostily segregated, with African Americans settling in the northern region of the city. And as we often saw before integration, blacks in the area created entrepreneurial opportunities for themselves, which housed an impressive business center that included banks, hotels, cafes, clothing stores, movie theaters, contemporary homes. Greenwood residents enjoyed many luxuries that their white neighbors did not, including indoor plumbing and a remarkable school system that superiorly educated black children. It's very interesting that back as early as 1920s, black folks were actually involved in having their own communities and supporting their own communities. So in 1921, the Greenwood District of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was the site of one of the most devastating massacres in the entire history of the United States. It was a massacre so ghastly, many chose to forget it, and it was hidden from textbooks and even oral historians for decades. As we struggle to understand contemporary violence against African Americans, it is especially important to know history and try to understand what happened. Well, known as Black Wall Street to those in the community, Greenwood in the early part of the 20th century was a thriving business district featuring African Americans owning business, strong black middle class, upper class schools, hospitals, theaters, and a bustling commercial and social island on the northeast side of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And in just 2 days in the spring of 1921, it was all destroyed. Put in today's terms, it was like $30 million in damage. 55 to 400 killed, 800 injured. Family fortunes had evaporated overnight. Many accounts of the demise of Black Wall Street referred to it as a race riot, but nothing could be further from the truth. It is better described as a terrorist attack on an affluent black neighborhood. The armed black men involved were defending their homes and businesses and their lives. Oklahoma, rich in oil deposits, became a state in 1907 and offered a promise of better life for many formerly enslaved African Americans looking for a chance to start over and get away from the still repressive southern states. In Tulsa, the Frisco Railroad tracks divided the white part of town from the Greenwood district called Little Africa. Laws prevented both whites and blacks from living in neighborhoods that were 75% the other race. So segregation naturally fell into place. It was a law that prevented folks from living together. Amazing. Red brick buildings sprang up along Greenwood Avenue, occupied by businesses owned by thriving black middle class that only grew during an oil boom in the 1910s. Theaters, nightclubs, churches, grocery stores thrived in the Greenwood District. The schools were superior of those of white areas, and many of the houses had indoor plumbing before those in the white area did. Because African Americans couldn't shop in areas that were predominantly white, a lot of the money spent in Greenwood went right back into the community. By the time of the attacks on the citizens of Black Wall Street, there were more than 10,000 African Americans living in the area. The community supported two of its own newspapers, the Tulsa Star and the Oklahoma Sun. The second covering state and national news and politics. But the community flourished. Disgruntlement and hatred did as well. The country was still reeling from the failed Reconstruction and furiously enacting Jim Crow laws. A number of African American men in one part of the United States have been accused of sexual attacks on white women and subsequently put to death, usually at the hands of a lynch mob. The Ku Klux Klan had approximately 2,000 members in the Tulsa area by the end of 1921. With returning veterans from World War I and jobs becoming more scarce, envy and racial tensions grew among some white citizens of Tulsa. This all came to a terrifying head on May 31st and June 1st in 1921. Over the course of 16 hours, almost every business, each hotel, both hospitals, libraries, the newspaper, doctor's offices were burned to the ground. Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Do some research. Read about it. I think it's very important. There's a message that says that we as African Americans can support our own communities if we spend the money, build within our communities, and life will be a lot better for us. So that was a bit of information I wanted to share with you. My co-host and I had talked about Bitcoin, which is a sort of like a cyber type of currency. And I've done some research on this Bitcoin, which is quite interesting. Cryptocurrency, it's called. A digital asset designed to work as a medium of exchange using cryptographic to secure the transactions and control the creation of additional units. So Bitcoin was created in 2009. It was first decentralized. It was the first decentralized cryptocurrency. Since then, numerous cryptocurrencies have been created, and they're called altcoins. And a lot of this is just traded over the internet. And through reading, it basically boils down to if you get involved in Bitcoin, Bitcoin is going to be determined by the goods and services you can purchase with a unit. And it's like anything else. It's only as going to be as good as what the seller is willing to acquire your Bitcoins for. But what I think the most interesting thing about this Bitcoin phenomenon is the amount of fraud and corruption. Back in 2013, there were two former agents from the Drug Enforcement Administration and the Secret Service. They were charged with wire fraud, money laundering, and other offenses for allegedly stealing Bitcoins during the federal investigation of Silk Road, an underground, illicit black market federal prosecutors shut down in 2013. So this new phenomenon is like anything else. It always has that seedy side to it. And I've had people talk about, you know, getting rich quick by investing in these Bitcoins. But again, it's like anything else. You got to do your research, know what you're getting into, because if you invest money in it, you could lose your entire investment, because there were folks that have lost quite a bit of money in this through fraud. There was one other one. In December of 2015, the owner of a now-defunct GAW miners website was accused of securities fraud following his development of the cryptocurrency known as Paycoin. He is accused of masterminding an elaborate Ponzi scheme under the guise of cloud mining, with mining equipment hosted in a data center. He perpetrated the cloud miners known as Hazlets to be mining cryptocurrency within the Zen portal, when in fact there were no miner activity mining cryptocurrency. Zen portal had over 10,000 users that had purchased Hazlets for a total of over $19 million U.S. dollars. On August 4th, 2016, a federal judge in Florida certified a class action suit against the defunct cryptocurrency exchange Cripsy and Cripsy's owner. He is accused of misappropriating millions of dollars of his users' deposit, destroying evidence, and believed to have fled to China. So, again, if you are considering getting involved in the Bitcoin frenzy, please do your due diligence, do your research, find out if you're dealing with a reputable company that you're investing your money in, because like anything else, There's always that dark side, the seedy side, and you could lose all your money. So that's a bit of a snapshot on Bitcoin. It sounds like in certain circles, it could be a very viable instrument in acquiring some wealth. Me personally, I am not comfortable with it. I'm just kind of old-fashioned and willing to continue to invest my money into the securities of Wall Street. And, of course, we know that's not 100% safe either. But we do have more controls in place for the regulation of trading and purchasing securities, mutual funds, life insurance policy, those kinds of things in the Wall Street market. So with that, we're going to finish up our show today. Next week, we will talk a little bit more about the credit, debt, and investing for the future. And in closing, I like to thank our sponsors here at 103.7 The Beat, our owner, PA, Meon, Big Rob. Those guys have been really great to work with. They've helped us out a great deal, and my hat is off to them for providing this platform for us to speak to the community. I'd like to leave you with a few words of wisdom. Often people who criticize your life are usually the same people that don't know the price you paid to get where you are today. So, I am Tony Williams, and for my co-host Chauncey Williams, what do I do now? Your guide to credit, debt, and planning your financial success on 103.7 The Beat.